Hey, and welcome to another episode of Crippled by Culture, where we talk about everything in life and related to the disability and chronically ill community. My name is Sean Gold, and I'm an author, advocate, and nonverbal public speaker for the disability community. To provide a quick visual description for accessibility, I'm a Black man with a white tracheostomy breathing tube in my neck. I am wearing a yellow t-shirt. And today I would like to thank Yuri Velez for being my voice in this episode. This is a Zoom call with me and the person talking for me, and my guests are in the other boxes next to it. In this episode, we are talking about the intersections of disability, art, and culture.
Before we get any further into the interview, I want to give a shout out to our partnering nonprofit festival for this series, Festability. As a board member, I helped put together a wonderful event in St. Louis at the Missouri History Museum. We had so many activities and vendors set up all over with an amazing headliner for our main stage. Getting to do this event was a dream come true. It is the best event in St. Louis to celebrate your disability unapologetically. Make sure you come out later this year. More information will be available soon. Thank you, Festability, for sponsoring the series. Now, back to the show.
Now, let's get to today's amazing guest. I'm excited as this is my friend and mentor. Christopher Robin Judson Worth was born with cerebral palsy in Bridgeport, Connecticut. His parents, due to hardship, put him in foster care. While in the system, he was educated in an institutionalized setting up until the age of 11. When he was adopted by a family from West Virginia. Today, Christopher is a community educator, organizer, with over 15 years of experience. He cut his teeth in community organizing through joining the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, or OVEC, where his organizing efforts centered on the environmental movement, namely the abolition of mountaintop removal. He holds training certificates from Missouri Jobs with Justice and Industrial Areas Foundation, IAF, founded by the father of community organizing, Saul Alinsky. Chris, thank you so much for being here today. How are you doing? Would you mind giving me a visual description of yourself, please?
I am a white male with presenting person with kind of big hooped gauge earrings, black glasses. I'm wearing a white t-shirt, and I have a big white beautiful smile, right? And I'm very spastic in my presentation. Sean?
I appreciate that. You gave me such a long, detailed bio that I'm going to use some of it to make some additional questions.
Okay. Sorry about that.
No worries. So this seems like a silly question to ask after your intro, but we're going to stick to the script. Do you identify with having a disability or chronic illness? And if so, do you mind sharing what disabilities or chronic illnesses you have?
Okay, I have cerebral palsy, along with dyslexia and dysgraphia. My type of cerebral palsy affects my lower limbs primarily, and and my ADHD. So, and I often say that my ADHD and my dyslexia are sort of my primary disabilities. My cerebral palsy makes me the sexy person I am in front of you, right? Right. But, the other, disabilities, the unseen disabilities have been more of a stumbling block for me in some ways.
And are the earrings new, Chris?
I've had different gauges for a while. These big ones are kind of new. So, yeah.
Can you tell us how your disability and disabilities affect you in your everyday life?
Well, they primarily act to make me move a little bit more deliberately, meaning that I have to think about my motions. You know, I'm here kind of today speaking to you as a visual artist, so those are where what my first two degrees are in. So as a visual artist, I have to be much more sure of what marks I'm going to make, sure of what moves I'm going to make in the studio. And cerebral palsy sort of forces that on top of kind of, I'm a little bit of a slow reader. Things take me a little bit more time to process, although I have a pretty advanced, kind of way of taking in information at the same time. Like I understand things pretty quickly, even though it takes a minute to be coded in this brain of mine. So I think those are those are the effects, I think. And as our time together unfolds, we'll talk about that more, I guess. But John.
Mm-hmm. And how old were you when you were diagnosed? And do you think that there are some other things going on that you feel are not diagnosed?
I've been pretty heavily poked and prodded in my life. So I think everything's been caught or everything's been captured in my experience. My cerebral palsy was diagnosed at about, I think, 6 months. It was noted that I think my aunt described me as kind of like a brick. It was hard to move me around. I cried a lot because I wanted stimulation and I cried more than most babies, I should say. That makes sense.
And have you had to go through your own internalized ableism? And how was or has that journey been towards your inner acceptance?
So it's funny that you asked, Sean, because, my dad, my adopted dad, just died, right? You know that. A couple months ago, it hasn't even been a year. What I found from able-bodied people was even with my kind of white privilege, even with my sort of all the gifts that life's given me, that internalized thought that I'm, that I'm too stupid. I'm going to use some pejorative words there, and too, I'm gonna fail at the next, at the next turn. Someone's gonna find out that I'm faking, right? Somebody's gonna find out that somehow my art is only accepted because I have a disability, right? So that exists for me even today. Right, even today. And I bring up my dad because his death sort of brought that stuff back to the surface. Now, As you know, Sean, I will be the first one to say to you that I would not be the same artist without my cerebral palsy. I would not be the same poet without my cerebral palsy, and the history of other artists that came before me with the same kinds of disabilities, right? Or disabilities, whatever. But you know, the ableism of able-bodied people can really fuck you up, right? And it remains a thing that I think I'll be fighting to overcome until I'm 85 years old, right? If I am granted to live that long, right? Even when, so you know, I have art in the Missouri History Museum, right? I'm a queer artist. I have art in that collection, Sean. And even when that happened, I mean, I had to say to myself, this is real, right? Because, you know, too often I'm told, oh, they just, or too often my mind says that they just like you because you're special, put quotes around that, right? And even though I, at the same time, I really value my cerebral palsy. I really value all my unseen disabilities because they're perspectives that nobody else has. And I don't mean that in some kind of liberal kumbaya way, Sean. I mean that because I wouldn't be, I literally would not be the same person, right? I might have given you too much there, I don't know.
Oh, I'm so sorry for your loss. How are you handling his passing?
Well, I mean, I'm making art out of it. I'm moving through it because, you know, in Buddhism, right? You know, I think of myself sort of as a Buddhist, right? As much as you can in the West. In Buddhism, you know, the idea is to confront pain and confront sorrow, that those things aren't things to deny, right? They aren't feelings that we tuck up under the rug, although in Western culture, we're taught to do that a lot. So I try to confront it. I still have a lot of pain. I'm still, you know, I still grappling with the relationship we had. You know, he didn't necessarily like that I was an art major, right? He didn't necessarily think that it was a thing to do, right? Because he wanted me to be stable, right? And disabled people need money, right? So how are you gonna have any money, right? And all that's, you know, well and good, but he and I often fought. So I'm still kind of coming to terms with kind of his new presence in my life. And, you know, this is going to sound funny to our viewers/listeners, because within the same weeks, my twin brother passed away. And, you know, I'm dealing with all of it, but I'm trying to make something out of it. If that makes sense.
Now, that's a lot. I hate our culture's view on pain and grief. It's really bizarre.
It is bizarre. Hopefully we can move away from that. way of thinking.
What do you think you've learned that stays with you on a daily basis from the disability community or a specific disabled person?
Well, you know, I'm constantly thinking about our history, whether it is, you know, the disability community and, you know, the Black Panthers, or the disability community and, you know, the sit-ins. I'm constantly thinking about where we fit. I'm also really trying to always keep in mind that, you know, the reason there are so many artists, right, who have had disabilities all the way through art history, right, is because being a person with a disability sort of does put you on the edge of a society. It does put you on the edge of society, even more than other identities, maybe, right? Mm-hmm. Even more than other identities, right? So that sticks with me. The idea that, like, we have a unique place in cultures, in times, you know, but we've been here since at least the High Paleolithic period. I think you've heard me and say that when I've been preaching other places, Sean. So, I mean, there's a huge history of people with disabilities making an impact on all cultures, right? And so I keep that in mind when I'm feeling like really bummed down. We're bummed out. Like today, we had a text from a friend inviting us out to dinner, right, tomorrow. And the thing is, like, that day before invitation, it really, look, you're shaking your head, right? Because you know it doesn't work for us, right? Even if she's 10 minutes down the road by car, that might as well be a desert, crossing the desert, right? So, like, things like that, you know, little things like that can really eat away at you. So you have to keep the big picture in mind. At least I do. That makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. Who taught you about disabilities? Sorry, let me go back. I could probably do it because I can ask my mom. Yeah. But a 24-hour notice really isn't enough.
No, it's not. And we love this person, so we don't want to be like, you should have told us, you know. You know, we always end up saying that, right? So, who do you want me to go on to that question, Sean, or who taught me about? So, this shouldn't surprise. Maybe it'll surprise you, but really, nobody started teaching me about disability history and disability culture, and really, really what, how it started. You want to know how it started? Is I became interested, you know, I had been going to these kind of radical spaces, you know, lots of people try, you know, I was in my probably early to mid 20s, and and crawling up the steps and in these buildings with no elevator in the middle of Appalachia. So I should preface that I haven't always lived in St. Louis. I grew up first in Connecticut in foster care, right? Similar to what my bio said. Then I got adopted by rich West Virginians. And it's important to say upper class West Virginians because, right, that changed a lot for me. Now, they didn't pour money at me. I don't think I was spoiled, right? But it opened the door for a lot of things. Before that, I was really being pushed in a very institutionalized direction, right? So I was in these spaces where I was really trying to shake things up, right? Because I had been adopted from a really, my cat is on the table here now, a really difficult spot, right? And I gotta pick up this keyboard.
Come here.
The things that will happen. So, Critter, get down. Get down, honey. Please. Hold on, I'm sorry, guys. So, without skipping a beat, she's on the other desk now. Without skipping a beat, so that sort of upbringing really led me to want to change the world. And I wanted to do it in such a way that included art and culture, right? But what I was unaware of was that, so I was looking for it everywhere but my cerebral palsy, right? Right, so I was fighting every fight, you know, being queer, being bisexual, right? There was a lot to, and coming from Appalachia, right? I came from a really rural, was adopted into a really rural situation, so I had a lot to fight, right? But I didn't see what was right in front of me until I was at a meeting and I had crawled up these steps. And I was sweating my ass off, guys, Sean, and on this pleather chair, those pleather, not real leather, slippery ass office chairs. So I'm trying to flip myself into this chair. Meanwhile, sweat is pouring because it's the dead of summer and there's window cooling systems in this. So it was hot. And I looked around and I thought, where are other people who are having to climb this chair like it's Mount Kilimanjaro? And then I thought, that led me to think, to start thinking about whether there was a social history for people with disabilities. Now that was probably my early to mid 20s. And I literally started Googling disability rights and disability history. And I learned about St. Louis and I learned about Berkeley, California almost immediately. And the reason we, St. Louis is at the forefront of disability history in America specifically is because, some of the founding shit disturbers from Berkeley came here, right? They were invited by a guy named Max Starclaw. You know, kind of a privileged white guy, you know, Sean, right? But he wanted to put his privilege into action. And I think he also didn't want to live in a nursing home, right? And so this history was brand new to me, but I was like, holy shit, you know, there, here's my people, right? Like a Moses moment, if you will, right? Not that I'm Moses, mind you. But it really helped me to understand that we've had, you know, we've had our own struggles, and we have our own sort of artistic and social presence.
Was Starclaw able-bodied?
He had a spinal cord injury after driving a really fast, beautiful car. He got into a wreck and had an injury in his, late teens, early 20s. You know, his family helped found Barnes Jewish Hospital. So, you know, he has some privilege, right? But, you know, he used it to benefit, I think, others.
Founding shit disturbers, by the way, is my new favorite phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know any of this, actually.
Well, you and I can have more coffee, Sean. Okay. So in Berkeley, you know, I brought up with you before the idea that the Black Panthers are and were a big part of, you know, the 504 sit-in, the sit-in that got us a lot of educational rights, right? Well, Bradley Lomax, you should, especially the listeners, the watchers of this, he doesn't get a lot of airplay, or hasn't in the past. I think he's getting more. But Bradley Lomax is a person with a disability, a Black man with a disability, who brought the two movements together to benefit each other. And I think that he's worth looking into. I make my students read a paper, have in the past. I'm not doing that this year, but you should look him up.
Thank you. Now to your involvement in the disability community, why was community advocacy for the disabled important to you?
Well, I think you know, our conversation here is sort of a perfect sandwich of this, you know, it's important because we have a community, right? It's important because rich white people, especially males, able-bodied, often still think of us, and you know, middle-aged white women in social work. I'm sorry to pick on you guys. They, you know, there's this idea that we still need help. The state of Missouri still calls us, you know, many politicians who I've worked with still call us the most vulnerable, right? And yes, there are vulnerabilities, right? I've been run over by a car, right? On my way to work, Sean, I mean, you could be taken down by a piece of food if you were to choke, right? Right? But society often thinks only of the things that we frame as weakness, right? You know, those things are not weakness necessarily, right? So it's important to me because it speaks to a wider culture, and we need to start to be embraced by the wider culture. And maybe that's already happening with millennials, and then the next, who are the next group? The Gen something, my wife's saying. But the thing is, I think that there are still situations where
Gen Z,
where people, they talk about, you know, people with disabilities in such, you know, in more progressive ways, but how many of them actually hang out with one of us, right? Just like, progressive white people often talk about, talk in the right ways about relations with Black people, right? But how many of them actually hang out with each other?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we silo, and so I, for one, will remain a community organizer, because I want to break down those silos.
Mm-hmm. What were your goals when you first started the organizing, and how did they evolve as years went on?
Well, I like, you know, I'm a proponent of community organizing because it takes on, I said proponent, but that appropriate word, I don't, anyway, of community organizing, because it takes on issues in chunkable, doable ways, right? So that in years past, we took on, call a ride, right? The paratransit for folks with disabilities, which happens to be really kind of punitive in the greater St. Louis area. We've taken that on. We've taken larger things on, restraint and seclusion, the idea that in some schools you can, as a person with a disability, you can literally be thrown in a box until you calm down, right? The seclusion. We took that on. The idea is that over time, really, I think the way I've changed over time is that when I was first starting out, I wanted to burn the whole system down, right? I wanted to, fuck ableists, right? Like, let's just stop everything and, right, and just burn it down, and maybe we'll build it back up at some point. But so in my younger days as an organizer, I was still very I didn't know how to play well with others. I knew how to play well with others that thought like me, but I didn't always know how to play well with others who might have different views, right? I think my later years, if you can call, I don't want to call myself old already, but comparatively maybe, Sean, right? I think now I understand what negotiation means, and I understand what power actually is. Like Donald Trump or the Orange Man, he thinks he's powerful, but he's blustery, right? He's blustery. He couldn't negotiate to save his life, no pun intended, right? I'm not threatening him on a podcast here, but but he couldn't, negotiate. And negotiation comes with maturity, right? It comes with like some sophisticated aspects, and and some people would say to me, Chris, we've been negotiating all our fucking life. We deserve, X, Y, and Z. Yes. In a perfect world, we would all get what we wanted, right? But negotiation is going to get you further, and you're going to have less gray hair for it. I don't know. That was a long answer, Sean.
No, it's great, but, and we're fully unfiltered here, so go for it.
I mean, that's what really what I had to learn to do, right? And lots of people, especially when I meet a younger organizer / advocate, they think I'm, full of crap, not that my knowledge is crap, but they want to do it now. They want to solve this now. Well, this fucked up system didn't become fucked up overnight. Right? So we need to be strategic. We need to be willing to play some chess. And we can get more out of that. My dad was my adopted dad was he was fond of me, especially when I was younger. He was fond of getting me all riled up because I'd get all spastic. Sometimes I'd even flop out of the chair, with passion and be like, you don't understand me, man. Right? And then he'd say, now, who's being irrational here, right? And so I played right into his game, right? So my point was often valid, right? But because I expressed it by flinging myself all over the floor, right? He could easily say, well, sorry, right? So in order for us to have a cultural impact, right, we have to be willing to organize. We have to be willing to negotiate.
Thanks. Can you, what was it like working with the OVEC, and how did it make you feel talking about the environment?
So it's so funny because I talk about this experience with my students at, so I teach at the University of Missouri, St. Louis in the Succeed program. So I teach folks with different types of disabilities. And I say to them, I was with OVE for 12 years, right? I volunteered. And, they often get, and their chest gets all puffy and they say, I would never volunteer for that long, right? But of course I was getting my Social Security and I was tutoring. So that wasn't the only thing I was doing, but I learned so much from that experience. I learned a lot about what not to do, right? You know, because OVEC was founded by some very passionate environmentalists, they didn't think about people very much. They thought about the birds, right? They thought about the wildlife. And they didn't care if the state of West Virginia, Kentucky, and Ohio, so the states, became a wildlife preserve, right? When you know, and at first that seemed okay to me. But as I got to know people, I was like, no, we need a system that includes everybody, right? So OVEC taught me a lot about that, right? Like, again, about negotiation and about how, you know, just because you are the head of an organization doesn't mean that you are always thinking the most clearly, right? Because people get so stuck on what they think the world should look like, right? I learned how not to do that. Then I had so my mentor, Abraham Mwara, he was from Kenya, but he had come to the United States for, his mom was from the United States, his dad was from Kenya, but Abe grew up in Kenya, and he was my mentor, right? And he would always challenge me, right? Because I'd be pissing and moaning about cerebral palsy. Something would, you know, not be going well. And because, you know, I had to climb up and down a lot of inaccessible spaces. And he'd be like, but you have some privilege, Chris. You have to think about that, right? And so he would always challenge me, Sean. And so I would never do that time in any other way than I did it, because, again, going all the way back to the beginning of our podcast, I wouldn't be the same person without those struggles. You know, lots of people didn't know why some kid who used a wheelchair was willing to drag himself around for the environment. I was literally told by some purist anarchist, right? There was a time that I thought of myself that way, not as a purist, but these folks thought that we would, like, people would just run into the woods and, like, reclaim the woods and eat granola all day or something. And they told me that they thought, so I was at a conference, right? And they told me they thought that people with disabilities would be collateral damage. These are 20-something-year-olds, right? Right? When the world repopulated into this anarchist haven that they envisioned. And I thought that was bullshit, and I told them so. But it was a very interesting world to come up in. Remember that during that period that I was in denial about my own disability, right? Remember, I was not yet thinking of it in a prideful way. right? I thought that I was somehow, if I pretended to be, you know, able, I would be accepted by these people.
So for those of you out there watching and listening, Chris introduced himself as an artist, but he is an internationally known visual artist with paintings hanging in two countries outside the United States. He received his Bachelor of Fine Arts and Master of Arts degrees in paintings from Marshall University. You talked about your degree in art a little bit. Why was the degree in art important for your career?
Well, it's important to my personhood because it gave me a language, right? Art in general gave me a language that moved beyond the physical, right? It got me thinking more about like my, what was happening in my head, right? It got me thinking about more, being more critical about the way systems work. Art allowed me to explore things, right, that I didn't need to be an expert at, right? Whether it be, things like, multidimensional kind of our realities are maybe multi-layered and multi-dimensional, right? Or maybe it was thinking about the impact of a substance on the environment. I didn't necessarily have to be a scientist to think about those things, or a philosopher to be able to think about those things. As an artist, I kind of had free range to grow my mental capacity. And remember from the beginning of the story, right? I wasn't taught to read or write. I rolled around on a mat all day in a school, right? For the physically disabled, right? We called it something else back then. I'm old, right? So art became a way for me to have a crash course in thinking, right? And I didn't have to be perfect at it, right? But I could say something. I could explore something. I could be critical. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So art became a fundamental language.
And what does it feel like to be internationally known for your work? I didn't even know this.
Well, I don't really think about it that much. I mean, it's cool. I could go to Japan and see a piece of my work hanging there. I could go to Australia and see a piece of my work hanging there, but again, I don't have the money to do that. So, I mean, I don't think about it that much. It's cool.
So you also hold a master's in curriculum development from University of Missouri, St. Louis.
I do.
Chris is pursuing his PhD work in special education with a focus in teaching and learning processes, which began in the fall of 2021. How have those classes been?
The master's went well. PhD is very difficult. Right now I'm in the heart of learning statistics. I remember I don't have a very strong math background, so I'm having to teach myself a lot. But I'm gonna persevere because I'm stubborn as hell. So
Do you feel like your accommodations that you've requested were always given to you in classes throughout the years?
No. I think they've gotten better about accommodating more recently. But when I was in, when I first started this journey, so back in 1999, you really had to be very loud about your requests. Higher ed has changed in that way for some. Now, I've also heard other people say that struggles are still pretty present. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same, Sean. The more things change, the more they stay the same. That, you know, just because we have more people with disabilities on campuses doesn't mean that people's attitudes are that different. Now, of course, my goal is to see a world where and that attitude does change and is changed, but we're not even to the point where we can talk about artists having a disability outside of the common things that we know, like, Van Gogh, right? He was bipolar, okay? And we can acknowledge that, right? Because we know that story. But almost every artist that you can think of throughout history, I'm sure can be linked to a disability, right? And we still don't talk about that in our art history books. You know, people don't talk about it on the back of their book jackets very often if they're a writer, right? Like, I don't know if this is true, but, you know, Stephen King doesn't talk about his depression impacting his story writing. I'm making that up. Maybe he doesn't even have that, you know? But, you know, until we start seeing disability as a part of the process, you know, until we start seeing disability as part of the process, people are still going to continue to try to hide it, unless they're like you and me, Sean, and they, you know, you can't necessarily do that.
As a disabled person, how is this PhD going to improve your career?
Probably in one way, honestly. People will take me more seriously.
And by the way, try not to get me in trouble with false diagnoses, Chris. No.
who knows? I don't know. I'm just making that up. So blame me. For all my white privilege, for all my, male presentation, right? I still get treated sort of, oh, it's Chris Worth, you know? Oh, it's the quirky Chris Worth. We know he'll do this, or, you know, I feel like I don't always get treated very seriously, even among people that we know. Right? Like, it's just like, oh, Chris, he's just going to be himself. Like, I want to be more than a good presenter. Right? I want to be more than a good public speaker, even though public speaking is fucking hard to do. Right? And you really do have to learn it. It's a thing that you learn over time. It wasn't something I was born with. But I know, I hope I can speak for you for a second, Sean. Like, we don't, like, I want to be a scholar, right? I want to be an artist. Sean, you want to be a writer, not just a public speaker. I mean, public speaking is fine, but my, I'm going to pull out my poor dad again. He used to be like, you could just be on a public speaking circuit as a person with disability. And I always avoided that because, like, that's a fucking easy way out in my mind. Right? I want to challenge and challenge other people. I want to be challenged and challenge other people. That makes sense. And I think public speaking can do it. But I think that it's almost expected out of people with disabilities if you are, if you're smart, right? Like, I hate that word, but you're going to be a public speaker. And I think that's fine. I like doing it. I make a lot of money.
And it is a skill to get better at.
Yeah. But it's not the only thing that makes me up. Right? Or you, Sean.
Any advice for disabled people who want to get degrees?
Expect that able-bodied people are going to throw one hurdle after another at you. I mean, I'm sorry to say this, just expect it, right? And even, maybe even more, the liberal people, the people who, they just love you. You know, you're such a fucking inspiration, right? Those people are the people we have to be the most cautious about, because they're going to say to people like me and Sean, even me at 40-something years old, they're going to say, well, we don't know if you're going to be able to do this or that, right? Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, liberals are worse than Republicans and conservatives with regard to that.
I think it's true. So just be willing to be stubborn. Be willing to say no, but also be willing to negotiate. Especially to our younger folks, even younger than Sean here, right? Right. Do some volunteering. Now, it doesn't have to be perpetual. It doesn't have to be ongoing forever, right, Sean? But, and also, and this goes to my research, Sean, be willing to take risks, because risks build our cognitive ability. Risks build our cognitive ability. And I'll just say this. Don't try not to operate in a box. Even when you think you're outside of the box, you might still be operating in it, right? So just be aware, try to be aware of it. I try to remind myself of it all the time. The box. It's created by society, by culture, to control. Any other questions?
Yes, please. How does art contribute to your advocacy?
Well, art is my language. It's a primary language. So it contributes to my whole being, including my shit disturbance, by giving me a a way to reflect. That's the most basic way. I have a kind of coffee table book coming out in like a month, maybe a little less. And the coffee table book is full of paintings that I did reflecting on, reflecting on being a Black person. Of course, I'm not Black, right? But I used it as a point of meditation because it got me thinking. It got me outside of myself, right? Not in anybody's shoes, right? I could never do that, but it got me thinking. So that coffee table book is full of, I think the subtitle is Meditations on, it's called Power, and then the subtitle is Meditations on Power.
So is art a form of therapy as well to you?
Well, I honestly hate thinking of art as therapy. I mean, it can exercise.
My bad.
It's okay. It's all right. I mean, lots of people think that way, right? Art, you know, painting is hard for me. It's not easy when I'm doing a painting to make it look like it's supposed to look. If I want to make it look like a cat, I have to work five times as hard to make that fucking thing look like a cat, right? If I want to make it look like just like a Yuri, if I'm doing a portrait of this voice, right? I have to work extra hard to do that, right? So art has never been, I've never seen it as a therapeutic thing. Now, it does help me kind of intellectually move through things. So maybe in that way it is a kind of therapy, but I don't like to frame it that way because, you know, I consider it work. Like, when I'm in the studio, when I'm writing, just like you, Sean, it's work for me. It's fun work. It's work that not everybody gets to do, right? So I'm lucky in that way, but it's still a lot of work. So I don't think of it as, that was a long way to say, no, it's not therapy.
What do you like creating most when you're making art?
Well, I love the portraits. I love making portraits. And sometimes the people drive me crazy because they want to look a certain way, right? But I like that. I like the psychological aspect of, you know, engaging with somebody's face in a new way.
Do you have anything you can share on screen today?
Let me see here. A series called the Red Tie Series. I'm gonna pull it up for you guys.
Do I need to allow you to share screen?
It says I can share. It says share screen. Great. Let me see if it'll work. All right.
Can you describe the painting for visual accessibility?
Sure. So I'm gonna go step by step here. It's separated into two halves. The top half has two figures kind of sitting in a deep blue, kind of sky blue, very ethereal air, with one of the figures in a kind of blue robe and the other figure sitting in a bath, like laying in a bathtub, Now, the blue-robed figure has his eyes completely covered by what looks like a piece of a tie coming off of the figure in the bathtub. But the blue-robed figure is also cutting the red tie with a pair of scissors. So trying to free themselves, maybe. Then the other half of the painting, and the figure in kind of the bathtub has this, one of his hands is sort of flopped down into the other half of the painting, is all black with white figures, sort of, they look like they've been chalked on to the canvas. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. There are three of them. So
is it oil paint, Chris?
It's acrylic.
Acrylic, right.
With some oil pastel. Mm-hmm. So, and the three figures. So all of this was, like, I was painting all of these around the time that we had the protests regarding Michael Brown's death, wrongful death, and Ferguson. So I was also thinking about, the dichotomy of being white in this culture against being black in this culture. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to unshare.
Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome.
As a disabled man, we're going to move on to new territory here. As a disabled man, how can you express your sexuality? And what has that journey been like for you?
It's been interesting. Remember, I came up in first inner city Bridgeport, Connecticut. Then I was adopted to rural West Virginia, right around the time I was hitting puberty. So can somebody stop that? Sorry guys, my technology is going off. Remember, we're talking about sex. So that was a very interesting time because I was very sexually unaware, but still had all these feelings coming, and I've always been attracted to both sexes. So I had that going on, and then a little late, maybe Sean, you can ask me deeper questions about it in a second, but a little a little bit later, I ended up in college, I was constantly trying to be either, seen as gay, or so I went back and forth. I was straight, because I was nervous about being in college for the first time. So, and at the time, talking about gender was very, and sexuality was much more closed off, right? So I was straight, and then I was totally gay, and then I was bi, and then I did a lot of yo-yoing in my early understanding of myself. And I understand now that fluidity is okay, but I even had partners who And then I'll get back into cerebral palsy a little bit and how disability impacted it. I had partners who wanted me to either acknowledge that I was gay or not, right? Like I got into physical fights with my last long-term partner before Julie because he didn't like that I called myself bisexual, right? He wanted me to be, he thought I wasn't being brave enough, right? Or something, right? So now back to cerebral palsy. Cerebral palsy really made it super difficult, at least for me, to express my sexuality because I couldn't get people, they immediately think of it as a fetish, at least in my mind, if they're hanging out and, doing things with a person with a disability, right? So they don't necessarily think about it on the normals. I don't like to use the word normal, but their normal spectrum of what they would do sexually. So I did a lot of like taking my shirt off at the gay bar, things that I would not necessarily do today. Swinging my shirt around my head, getting drunk off my, things that I should not have done then, made me very unsafe, but it was the way I thought to get attention, right? Because nobody was, like, we weren't talking about poetry. we weren't talking about paintings. Does that make sense?
Yeah. What do you say to people who think we don't deserve love or to explore our bodies sexually as disabled people?
I think that's bullshit. First and foremost, I think that there are people who think that, but they're super afraid of themselves. They're super afraid of their children if they're doing that to their children. And they're not really friends to people who, they are why we're still living in such a divided country.
Yeah. You have any recommendations for toys for people with disabilities?
So I won't be able to share this with my mom. All right. Well, there's what's her name? Julie, who's the small person that we know?
Mary Lou
Nicarato. Yeah, you guys, Sean, you should look up Mary Lou Nicarato. What? Nicarato. Can you say it louder for Sean?
Nicarato.
Mary Lou Nicarato. She puts out all sorts of adaptive equipment, as far as vibrators, as far as...
She doesn't have an app store. She has an app store,
Greg. So click on it. She'll give you lots of different... like extenders,
Cool. Side note, Julie, get on my schedule.
Yeah, he wants to do one of these with you, Julie.
Okay.
We'll talk about it later.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'm talking.
Okay. Do you have any apps or accessible ways that you recommend for dating? And what tips do you have for dating with?
I would suggest that you don't think of many of the apps as solid dating platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want to have other kind of experiences, those are the places to go, right? Maybe. But as far as dating, I've been out of the dating arena for a minute. So, but
how about advice for non-disabled folks who are dating someone with a visible disability?
Understand that learning our bodies can be a very sexual, pleasurable thing, right? So it's not always, like you can literally get to know people. Did that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, by get to know people, I mean really get to know people.
What age do you think people with disabilities should start learning sex education? I sadly didn't learn until college, which is way too late.
Yeah, from the earliest. So I wish I had been thinking about this in simpler ways when I was 6.
Yeah. And a disturbing statistic, about 50% of sexual assault victims are disabled. How do you think the community can address that issue?
Very simply, educating. For as terrible as that number is, if you looked at successful sex ed programs, you would find that that number jumps way down, right? Because when people stop calling their body, their sexual body parts, UUs and winkies and I don't know what's another, wee-wees, when they start to actually know their body, then they can ask for what they want and indicate what they don't want for real.
Yeah. And it's such an important and sensitive, obviously, topic for our community. So if you're out there and you need it, please reach out for help. Are there any specific resources for the disabled community that you have about sexual assault?
I don't know one specifically.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But can I offer an interesting book on disability history?
Please.
So there's an amazing book called A Disability History of the United States by Kim Nielsen. And I would suggest that everyone buy that fucking book. Because if we want to move things forward, we have to know that these aren't foreign. This isn't a foreign history. It isn't somehow different from the history experienced by other people, but it does have some unique qualities.
Yeah, thank you. We'll share it with our viewers and listeners. Chris,
yes.
You're my longest interview to date, damn it.
Yeah.
Was there anything that I forgot to ask that you wanted to discuss today? I loved it, by the way.
Thank you, Sean. I didn't realize I'd be tired, but I'm tired. welcome to some cardiovascular workout, cerebral palsy special, right? I want to reiterate that there are also, so I'm pulling back in our story a little bit, there are also a ton of people with disabilities in either poetry, in any written form, and the visual arts, and in music, that go beyond just who you think you might know, but also those people might not acknowledge their disability, yet as a piece of what brings their art some different dimension. But we need to start recognizing that disability is a part of what makes some people's artistic output, it's a part of what makes that artistic output unique, right? It's not the whole part. Julie, can you? It's not, sorry, guys. Hold on. It's not the whole part, but it's. We'll call back. I just hung up on my mom for you, Sean. It's not the whole part, but it's a strong part, right? Like your queerness, Sean, is informed by your cerebral palsy. Right, you can't escape that. Right. All right.
Well, Chris Worth, thank you so much for coming on and having this amazing conversation with me. I hope you have enjoyed it as much as I did. I'm so appreciative of the insights that you provided as well. If people wanted to connect with you and support the work you're doing, where can they do so?
Well, I know you can email me at crjworth@gmail.com. That's the easiest thing to say.
Awesome. Great. I'll make sure to share everything in my description below. Once again, everyone, I'm Sean Gold. Thank you so much for watching and listening. Make sure you like, comment all your thoughts, and subscribe. And I'll see you next time on another episode of Crippled by Culture. Thanks, Chris.